Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Alan Cumming, and welcome to My Shelves. My shelves are sort of a museum of my life. I like to keep things from my travels that are, to me anyway, the very essence of the experiences I've had. Sort of portals, if you will, to a specific time and place. And the inspiration for stories and memories and musings.
Here's my little battery-operated fuck box. You press a button and these things happen.
Fuck off! Fuck with you. Oh, don't fuck yourself.
Here's a lighter, one of those ones with petrol in it that you flick up like this, you know? And it's from the Vanity Fair dinner that I went to at the Oscars a couple of years ago, and it's got a quote on the side that says, "As you get older, the pickings get slimmer, but the people sure don't."
And today I'm talking to my old chum and cop partner, Bojana Novakovic.
So I have a question for you. When you first started performing...
Go away.
So fucking go hell!
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Bojana Novakovic was born in Serbia and grew up in Australia and later moved to the United States of America. She is an actress of huge renown, having appeared in film, television and theatre for the past 25 years. But we first met when we starred opposite each other in the CBS TV series Instinct, in which I played one of those sort of dopey genius people who are brought into the NYPD as a sort of consultant. And Bojana was my hard-bitten, slightly pissed off with me NYPD detective. We had a total hoot. And the item from my shelves that we're talking about today is a Polaroid photograph that Bojana took of me, herself, Dan Ings and Naveen Andrews, two other people in the cast of Instinct. And it was taken at the read-through for the pilot episode of Instinct. And that was a very nerve-wracking read-through, let me tell you, at CBS headquarters in New York City in 2017. Bojana, what do you remember about the... Did you hear any notes or anything from that first reading?
So you must have a different recollection to me, because I don't remember notes from the reading. I remember them being freaked out that you and I didn't have chemistry and that the repartee wasn't working. And that it wasn't until we had that rehearsal at Mark's house, the director's house, that they were satisfied.
Who were they? Like Mark and
Mark and Michael.
Michael, the producer, the runner.
Yeah.
But they thought we didn't have chemistry after the first reading.
No, I don't know if that was... Yeah, something like they were really worried about the banter not working and me and you not being on, like, on top of each other's lines and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, we are trained actors.
I mean, come on. You're in this really stilted, weird environment around all these big tables. It's sort of like a wedding and you all have got food and you all sit there and they say, oh, don't, this is just a casual thing. It's all just fine. Don't, you know, don't panic. It's all just
for us to sort of gather. Yeah, and then your agent before has called you going, you might, you know, like you still, like they still have been known to fire people after a table read. And I'm like, I'm 37.
What, your agent said that?
Years old. Yeah, I'm like, I'm 37 years old. Like no one's going to fucking fire me. Like, shut up.
Oh my God.
Like, I'm not 12.
God, it's brutal,
it's my first job. Yeah, yeah.
God, that was so funny. I had no idea. I mean, I remember we went to Mark's house, but maybe it was just, I didn't know, maybe it was some things with the script. I can't remember. It's sort of funny, isn't it, when you start a new thing and you've got to sort of, you've got to get into the groove of it and you just have absolutely no time to do it before everyone is looking over your shoulder and telling you what's wrong with it.
Yeah, but I think it's really nice to remember that, like, that every single person who has a role in the creation of it, including actors, creators, writers, producers, they're all just as panicked about their own contribution as we are about ours. Like, they're all thinking, what did I do wrong? Hopefully. Some aren't if they're megalomaniacs. Right. Yeah. But most people in our profession are always like, oh, it's all my fault.
Yeah. I never think that.
Well, that's why you're what do you call yourself? International celebrity of world
top international celebrity.
That's why you're top international celebrity.
I thought it was so funny that just you know, in that show actually, it was sort of, I felt very free. Like I just thought it was so, when you're at the center of a storm, when everything, and you know, it was a new show. It was the first time there had been a gay leading character on network drama, all that stuff. They were, you know, there was a lot going on behind the scenes that I think, I mean, I was an executive producer on it. So I got a little bit of access to a little bit of it, but they still tried to keep it away from me. You know what? I didn't care. I actually didn't care. I just thought, this is fun. I'm doing this. It's not brain surgery. You know what I mean? We're not solving cancer or curing cancer. We're just here to, it's like a dopey cop show, but with really fun and bright and sort of witty things in it. Just let us do it.
Yeah. Well, I had a different perception of it, Alan. I took it very seriously. It was literally, look, I can see your eyes rolling already and the set dynamic coming back. I notated all my, because you know why? Because you're very good at that stuff. And that's not my forte. Like, I'm great with the drama and the theatrics. And like, I love comedy, but I love comedy without a script. I love improvising. I like, you know, being goofy. But when it's a script, I'm like, okay, what's the comedic timing? How many seconds between this and this word? What's the intonation? Like, I'm like,
oh my God, yes.
I'm like Andy Kaufman when he was a kid on his bed. Yeah, it's a science. And you're like at work going, I'm having a break from everything.
I do remember, I think we do actually approach work in a very, very different way. And I think that was kind of what made it so fun and what actually did make our chemistry on screen really good, because we were sort of, you know, quite antagonistic in our, as characters in the show, but also we really had a laugh and loved each other as well.
I know, I loved giving you shit. You're about your age, and what did you give me shit about? My sex life.
Yeah. I was just feeling that you should have been having a more healthy and, you know, in the prime of your life, you should have been
having
more sexually active. I'm always telling people I think they should be having more sex. I am. It was so funny. My old assistant, Jimmy, and his roommate, Will, like, I used to get onto them all the time. I was like, you boys, like, you're in your 20s. What the hell is going on? You're in the prime of your life. You should be out getting much more sex than you're having. And they started to go, oh, I had sex with blah, blah. And I don't need to know the details. A couple of weeks ago, I had sex. I'm like, oh, that's just, no, you've got the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah,
I don't
want to actually impress you. Yeah. It's for their own good.
Now, this photo, I think it was such a lovely thing to do. It's a Polaroid. Of course, people don't really have Polaroids anymore so much. I think it's a lost, because it's such a lovely thing to have a palpable thing and not just like a photo in a frame. It's like a little sort of thing you can carry and you can just move it around. And I love a Polaroid. I think it's a really great sort of way to hold a memory. And I miss them. And so why were you, because you are a very good photographer. You've taken some beautiful pictures of me, if I say so myself.
Yes, I have. You're a beautiful subject, Alan.
Thank you. I wasn't fishing. So tell us about your photography interest and/career.
Well, I do want to add that I'm holding a Polaroid of you and myself right now from one of our first days of shooting that first pilot, that first episode. I have one as well where I'm blowing, like I'm pouting a kiss near your ear and you're looking straight at the camera with the right side of your lip raised, and it looks great. Oh. It's very, very cool. It's very cool. So I have that in my wallet.
What, like an Elvis sort of thing?
Yeah, like an Elvis sort of thing, exactly. But you don't look like Elvis. You look better.
I look like that weird little man that I was. So that's so nice. So why do you carry that?
I don't know. I really like it. And I've always, I don't know why. I mean, I don't know. It's just there. It's there with a picture of myself and Jacqueline. I've got two Polaroids in my wallet. It's just always sat in there. Because normally I give them away, but I guess I wanted to keep that one. Mm. Hang on a second. You asked me about my photography.
Yeah, I was going to ask you more about it. I was going to veer you back to the subject.
Back. Well, my parents gave me a camera when I was 12. And I started taking photos when I was very young. And it was something that I did all my life. And at school, I would spend all of my free periods, because we would have these free periods when we weren't in class, developing black and white photographs in the dark room. And I had my own projector and I did a whole bunch of stuff. And then over the years, I just kept taking them and taking them and taking them and kind of learned a lot and read a lot about photography, different cameras. I bought different cameras. I lost some cameras. You know, you left them on the streets of New York. And mostly I was doing film cameras. Oh. And then at some point when the Canon 5D Mark II came out, because that's a full frame, it's a really beautiful camera, I bought that. Uh-huh. I've had it for 10 more years. And I'd never exhibited my photos ever. But I went to Nepal after the earthquake, and of course I took my camera because working with these women who I'd met, who are mountain climbers. You know, we did a fundraiser for them.
How did it all come about, that part, the Nepal connection?
The Nepal connection came about because my beautiful friend Joel Edgerton introduced me to the Seven Summits women. I know, me too. Introduced me to the Seven Summits women, who are a group of seven Nepali girls who were the first female team to summit Everest successfully, the first female team to summit Everest successfully, and then to summit the highest peak on every continent. And I got to talking with them. They stayed with me for a little while in LA and stuff like that when they were raising money for their Antarctica climb. And I got to talking with them about a lot of the work that they were doing. And two of them were doing these rehabilitation work with sex trafficking survivors in Nepal. And and I knew that once they finished their climbs, they wanted to sort of, they established a group that works on that, and that's all they do. So they teach these women who have either come back from India or escaped their fate. They teach them sort of mountain skills, climbing skills. They give them, they rehabilitate, like part of their rehabilitation is reacquainting them with the land and things like that.
And with a view to them, like getting jobs as guides
that's exactly right. And if nothing else, then it's a reconnection with the land. And then, it's part of a larger program that a foundation called Mighty Nepal has for them. And they were working on that. And I said to them, oh, I'll come and, you know, once you guys are done and at this and this time, I'll come to Nepal and I'll work with you guys and see what you need and see how we can raise awareness and raise some funds and things like that. And then the earthquake hit. So all of the girls actually went, I think four of them were employed by the UN to work on the UN food program to deliver food to areas that were affected by the earthquake that were impossible to get to. So they would literally like mountain, they would like climb and hike basically to these really remote areas. And then another couple of them actually decided to stay in one of their villages and help the population there. And so Joel and I sort of spoke and we got some money together and I went over there and I worked with them on rebuilding some schools and just getting some.
And what do you mean? Like what did you mean? Actually physically working?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Physically working, yes. I do physical labor, yes. I'm capable. And so I lived with them for like 3 or 4 weeks, I think, there. And I took a bunch of photos because we're talking about my photography. But yes, it definitely does. There's a great kind of cross sectioning of these stories. And while I was there, I was writing to friends of mine in the US saying, hey, like, this is what's happening here. If you're going to donate money to somewhere, donate it here because I know where it's going. I can see who it's going to. And, you know, there's just so many problems with bigger NGOs wasting money on admin and all that stuff. And we ended up raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for these projects, which encompass seven schools, food programs for those schools, teachers, all this stuff. It was really beautiful. And it's still going. So two of the schools are sort of still going because the girls realized, oh, this is actually an opportunity for us to improve the education in these remote areas. So some of those projects are, God bless them, being funded by still being funded by some of the people who were interested in helping us initially. And
that's great.
The photos, the photography, and what you asked of my photographic career, which I never planned.
I love you. Like, look at the scale of bringing this story back around.
I never planned to have. But when I returned to LA, because I went there a couple of times. So when I returned to LA, I showed the photos to John Papsidera, who's actually a wonderful casting director, and he has a little gallery. He's obsessed with art. He has beautiful art. And we sort of agreed, I don't know whether it was his idea or my idea, but to exhibit some of these pictures from Nepal. But he has a very intricate sense of art and aesthetics. And so we actually agreed that the photos, the exhibit would be of photos that actually made the area, like the beauty of the area, rather than like your typical, like, oh, you know, people without homes and this, like, this sort of kind of poverty porn, I hate, right. you know, pictures. I love taking photos with lots of color and a lot of color. And they're very fantasy-like, the pictures that I like to take, but they're real people and real landscapes. And so we chose these pictures that really show the beauty of the place and the different colors and the rice fields and the way the people are within the landscape. And we raised a lot of money just through that exhibit. And so that was the first time I exhibited. And then some gallery owner from LA saw those pictures and then wanted to give me an exhibit and then started representing me. And then I realized that, like, he and the art world is not for me because it's just so brutal and strange and corrupt and weird. And I didn't like working with him at all. And he said that he would donate money, you know, for everything that he sold, and he never did. He, in fact, didn't even pay me.
He didn't?
No, he owed me money. And then, and then I left, got the money that he owed me because he sold a bunch of my works to, you know, his rich clients. And I got the money as quickly as I could, got out of there, and I found out that the gallery went bankrupt and he owes artists hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So you're lucky to get the money.
Yeah. And I donated the money that I made, it was donated. Because I didn't want to make money out of something that I actually, like, enjoy doing. Like, to me, you know how many photos I take? It's like a third limb. It's just something I do. And right now I'm even editing a documentary about my aunt. And a lot of the material.
One about, I love this story,
And a lot of the material is like 20, 30 years old from when I was a kid filming her. And I didn't even know that I would ever use it in a movie, but I've just always had a camera. You know, I've always, whether it's a camcorder or a film camera or I've got two cameras here with me. I'll take photos of us when we get out. I've always had it, so it's never something I wanted to make money from.
I'm intrigued by that. Like, you don't want to make money from things that you work that you enjoy.
No, it's
not that.
Does
that mean you don't enjoy acting?
No, I do enjoy acting. It's not that. It's more the fact that, like, I didn't want to make money from taking pictures of people in Nepal and their landscape and that stuff.
I get that part.
That felt really ridiculous.
So it's just that.
No, I'm more than happy to sell some of those pictures of you to someone. If you find me a buyer.
You know, remember when we were I should tell people that. So there was a German magazine, Schön, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wanted to do an article about me. Oh, and they wanted you to interview me.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And then you were going to do the photos too. So we did a weekend up at my house in the Catskills, and Bayana had brought all these voluminous dresses for me to wear, and we sort of talked about doing them in the water, and I love the idea. I love being photographed in the water and underwater and everything. And so we did some, like, with me wearing all these dresses. It was a bit sort of like Ophelia, you know, that painting of Ophelia with her big long frock. Very, very like that. And we did something in my swimming pool, but we needed more, wanted a different swimming. There was a pond down the hill that a couple of years before I tried to buy it. It was like just a lovely pond. And the man said, and he was asking too much money. And I said, I don't want to buy it. And he said, well, just go and swim in it whenever you like. And I said, the only thing I wanted to do with that pond was swim in it. And he said to me, I could just go and swim. So I thought, why would I want to buy it then? It's so great. It worked out really well.
But don't touch the bottom because you'll get all the leeches.
Oh, the leeches. There's leeches in it. Well, that's yes. You just flick them off. So it's a lovely pond, though. And it's just it's so beautiful. And so we went. I said, let's go down there. So we went into the pond. I had some big frock on, lots of guy liner and lippy. And was sort of, you know, flouncing around in the water. And you were you in the water too?
Yes.
Or were you on the edge?
Yes. I was everywhere. And we went to the other side. And then I would walk in and walk out. We've got pictures. I've got photos of me shooting.
That's
you.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you did? Because I really love those pictures. Those are my favorites.
Yeah.
And anyway, so as we were doing it, and there was Chris, who is your camera assistant at the time, and Grant, my husband, they were kind of with us.
I love that.
Doing things. And all of a sudden, like a truck comes down the little track, a big, huge sort of, you know, country truck. And we were like, uh-oh, what's going on here? And Grant sort of said, I'll go in, you know, and I'm in the water in a fucking huge dress. And you're sort of in with me with snapping away. And we look obviously insane. And Chris has got a screen, you know, one of those big screens.
Chris is holding reflector that thing.
Grant goes up to them and he's sort of going, hello. And the guy goes, what's going on? Oh, is it Alan? Oh, that's fine then. It's fine if it's Alan. And I thought it was going to be like a deliverance moment. And all of a sudden there was like, oh, it's Alan. That's fine. Yeah. Oh, he's wearing a dress.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, of course.
But I really do love those pictures. And yeah. I loved, you know, what I really liked about it was that you really planned it. You really sort of, you know, you went to such great lengths. You're very, well, I mean, that's what you're like with your acting as well. And I'm not. I'm very disorganized. And I mean, I don't really, I'm very much sort of wing it. And I was just thinking about my brief sort of skirmish with the photography world. I had an exhibition of photographs called Alan Cumming Snaps. That's why my Instagram is called Alan Cumming Snaps, because I had that book of photographs and stories. But it all went sour with the sort of the gallery thing that I was doing as well. I had a very sort of, it didn't end well. It felt a bit weird.
Yeah.
And I also didn't like the energy of that industry. It's so interesting.
Yeah. I didn't like the energy of that world at all.
No. Isn't that fascinating?
It's weird.
Going back to instinct.
Oh.
We had such fun. I thought we had such a laugh on that show. And partly it was because we were sort of running the asylum in a way. Like, you know, we got to, like, the atmosphere on set was completely dictated by us. We had a speaker on the dolly, and Edgar, our camera operator, would, like, you know, DJ in between takes, and we would dance in between takes every single time. And it was such a fun thing to do. Actually, I mean, I really loved it because I love just kind of, you know, having fun, and then suddenly you switch off and now you're really in the zone. And I love that about it. I love kind of relaxing and being right up to the point when I have to focus.
That's Mel Gibson does that. That's how he is as well. And I remember the first time I worked with him, I was like, oh God, no, no, no. I need to be in my zone. What are you doing? Go on. Sorry, I interrupted you. But you are in your zone,
but just when you need to be. I remember when, like, guest stars would come on and we'd be, you know, like, we're doing some scene about a gruesome body who's been, you know, taken out of the Hudson River with its head chopped off or something, and we are doing that, and then we'll suddenly be like, everybody dancing away, like the wardrobe people are trying to, like, do our last checks, and we're dancing around. I just thought it was so, and people loved coming on our show because of that sort of atmosphere. And I think it made such a difference to the mood on the set, because everybody danced, everyone felt not so inhibited in front of each other, and everyone talked to each other in a way that I don't think they do normally on sets.
No, it was very respectful. And I actually remember that whenever we did have anyone problematic, they got let go. Toxicity. Like, toxicity wasn't allowed. And I think that's very, that unfortunately that's rare for sets. And it definitely was, an amazing experience for me to see that you can make lovely television with lovely people and have a lovely time doing it, and that not everything needs to be. Yeah. And I honestly, I know that this is your show, and you know how loath I am to give you too many compliments, like, but you were a very, very
good. I know how much this cost you. Whatever you're going to say, I know how much it cost you.
Thank you. Like, you facilitated us to be able to do that, right? So if you hadn't wanted that kind of stuff, it wouldn't have happened, because you're number one on the call sheet. That's what number one, that's what happens. And
well, also I guess because I was a producer, I think partly as that as well.
Yeah.
I kind of had one foot in both camps. So you're actually able to have a conversation about the mood on the set. And
it was just really lovely to learn from you about being a leading man who does that and kind of takes care of the atmosphere on set just as much as the quality of the work. I really, really appreciate, and I know that I'm getting serious now, but I really appreciate that because it left a real mark on me. And I won't, like, I hope I never get anything less. And I hope that when I'm one on the call sheet, I'm never anything less than that. Like, you've set a bar.
No.
And I really, really, I really love that. And I really appreciated it. And I know everyone else
that's
did.
That's nice. Thanks, bye-bye.
That's all right.
Thank you so much.
Hello and welcome to Out to Lunch with me, Jay Rayner, the podcast in which I take a particularly brilliant famous person to a top restaurant and grill them to a turn. In this latest season, you'll find me having delicious dinners with the likes of Patrick Keelty, David Hare, Nina Conti, Dame Eileen Atkins and Mary Beard, and the reliably outrageous Miriam Margolyes.
Richard E. Grant was on that.
He has an always compulsion to smell whatever's around him. Has he never come and sniffed you?
Probably wisely, no.
All that and so much more. So do join me. Out to Lunch with Jay Rayner. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Also, I was thinking today how I really like making people feel sort of lose their inhibitions and to let go.
You do. Something, it's and like I was an thinking, obsession why, of yours.
Why, it is. And I'm thinking, why is that? Why do I think? And I think actually it's because I used to feel like that.
Mm.
I used to be the person who was sort of worried about people judging me about singing a song that was a bit tacky or dancing to a pop song. You know, I think I was that. Mm. I used to be that person. And I think I realized that, you know what? No one cares. No one actually cares. Mm-mm. The only person who cares is you.
Yeah.
And I think that's, it's so easy to say, but actually, and I think what I do, it's like when I DJ, I always dance. Now I think, why would you, when you go into a club and you, or a party or whatever, and you see the DJ, if they're not dancing, why the fuck should you dance? You know, basically it's like saying, you know, here's something I want you to buy, but I'm not buying it, basically. And so I think it's really important to, I find it like, I think it's so fun to, and also getting older, I think that's the thing that I also don't give a fuck. You know, you
yes,
give less fucks as you get older.
I definitely second that. So I have a question for you. When you first started performing.
I mean, go away. I didn't mean go away.
Fucking hell.
Go ahead.
On your way. When you first started performing, who was it that was watching you? Like not literally, but in your head, who were you performing for? You know, because there's always that hierarchy and there's a hierarchy, I think, when you care what other people think, that in the audience is sitting that entity. Who was that for you? like a lover, or someone that you wanted to be with, what was that entity?
I think it'd probably be my dad. I mean, my dad was this big sort of shadow over so much of my early life.
Oh,
and I think,
I didn't want to go there.
You know, I suppose I felt like, you know, being, I don't know. I mean, I had that really weird thing growing up where my dad told me I was useless, literally, and my mum told me I was precious.
Yeah.
So I had this really weird thing where I knew they couldn't both be right, but I felt more inclined to think I was probably on, you know, veering to the useless side for a while, for a long time. But I don't know what, you know, I had this thing when I was 21. So I'd left drama school when I was 20. And when I was 21, I was, you know, I was working when I got out of college, and I did a season of plays at the Royal Lyceum in Edinburgh, and on the last one, well, three plays, and in the last one, it was called Mr. Government. And I remember one matinee, I was doing this scene. I was playing this sort of boy with learning difficulties, and with I was doing a scene with my mum and this woman in the play, and I just suddenly in the middle of the scene went, "Oh my God, that's what acting's about. Oh, I see. Oh, I've got it now." And I walked back to my dressing room and thought, "Oh, I see. I was completely barking up the wrong tree." And it was, you know, and I feel bad for all the people who paid tickets to see me and things up till then. You know, and it wasn't that it was really bad, but I could have been so much better. And you'd think I would have that epiphany at drama school or something. But no, it wasn't until a couple of years out of drama school. But it was like a penny literally dropped. Wow. It was so clear. And it was so much about, I used to think, it's kind of like the thing we're talking about not caring so much, but in a way. But I used to think that acting was all about putting stuff on top of yourself, like disguise, hiding yourself, trying to hide and making a new person, almost sculpting a new person around you. And then in that moment, I realized if I just, you know, felt it and tried to be myself all the time, but let myself come through, be authentic, you know, make an authentic person. And that's when everything changed for me. And I think it's interesting because in America, especially, you know, that whole notion of a movie star is someone who basically is the same all the time. They're a sort of a personality. Yeah. It's the cult of personality is so huge there. It's not that. You are, you know, you can be vastly different and look vastly different, but in a way you're allowing a part of yourself to come through and you're connecting with the audience as yourself, like the way that human beings connect, rather than trying to obscure your very essence.
Yes, Slavoj Žižek talked about that. I completely understand what you're saying because my relationship with acting.
Who's that?
Slavoj Žižek is a Slovenian philosopher who teaches, I think, sometimes at NYU, but he speaks about, there's a very, very funny little thing that he said about how, I mean, look, you'll relate to this as do I, that there's a falsity in the real world. And you, when you go to the theater, you go to see truth because that's what performers are presenting to you. And it sort of reflects what you just spoke about, because I remember feeling kind of odd, you know, faking it sometimes in terms of performances when I was younger, whereas of course now you know that that's kind of what you need to do.
Yeah.
But I was always obsessively searching for authenticity in everything that I did. And I think that's kind of hard, like, to do when you're working on, you know, commercial television in the US. It's just like you're coming to work and you're just having a good time and you're doing that thing. But when you, for example, like with the show that I'm about to do and that you're about to be, you know, that you're about to be a guest in, I play a different character all the time. So sometimes I'm, you know, I'm Serbian, sometimes I'm eccentric, sometimes I'm quite shy. I play a different character every night depending on what the guest is going to come in with.
Tell us about that, because in case people don't know about the Blind Date Project, what is that?
So the Blind Date Project is an improvised hour of ostensibly a blind date between me and myself and a different performer every night. So the premise is that I play a character, the other performer plays a character, we meet in a karaoke bar, mind you, to go on a blind date. The technicalities around the show are directions are sent to us via text messages and phone calls by the director. There's no set ending.
During the show, During the show.
What happens so is entirely up in the air.
I did it once at Club Cumming.
Yeah.
And it's so crazy. Like you walk in, I walked into Club Cumming, you're sitting there and you must have known it was going to be me that time, did you?
Because no, the first time I only knew when I saw your husband walking in. And I was like, did he really have to come in right? I didn't know until the moment just before you came in. I would have been so shocked. I had no idea it was you. None.
So they walk in and and you've worked on the character with the director in secret. And then during the course of the play, so you sort of go and you sort of introduce yourself and you're improvising, obviously, like you would on a blind date. It's so clever. And then you get a text and you get a call and Boyana does too, and then you go up and sing a song, and so it's sort of shaped by the director from, you know, as it's happening. She's in the audience texting you and everything. It's hilarious. And sometimes I think at one point she asked me to go outside and we had a chat outside,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I went back in again.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so exciting. And it must be, it must be so challenging, but it must be so fun
it's
for you to be
so
a different person every time.
I literally poop my pants before every show, and I've done over 150 shows. And but that's
a lot
that's
of poop.
The author. It's a lot of poop, but I'm vegan. It's easy. but the authenticity in that show, and sort of you have to come from yourself, even though you're not. I can't tell my own story every night, right? Nor do I want to, because it's all about love, desperation, seeking intimacy, seeking partnership, that kind of thing. And it's really exploring desperation in all its glorious forms. But I find I love, a drama teacher taught me this actually, Alan. He taught me about going through an entire script for every single line, writing a characteristic that comes out for that line. This is before you do any script work. And then looking at all the characteristics you've written down and choosing the top five, and then looking at those top five, and say one of them is aggressive and another one is murderous and another one is, fantasy driven or whatever, that you then explore those characteristics within yourself. And so I love kind of looking at a character and going, okay, what are the main characteristics of this person? And then going, okay, when am I, obsessed with fantasy? Or when am I, aggressive? Often.
Murderous, yeah.
Murderous or whatever it is. What would drive me to that? And then finding those moments, and what he would get us to do, and this is in high school, he was amazing. What he would get us to do is do a physical exercise that elicits that characteristic in us, so in Boyana. So, and it was so beautiful. And I really like doing that. And I like doing that for this show, because sometimes I have to play a math teacher or something. So then I spend the day researching, polynomials or whatever, certain things, graphs, and just little I make her a high school math teacher, not a math professor. Or certain theorems that haven't been solved or whatever. I research some of that, and then I kind of get into that, and I get into the art of mathematics and the philosophy of mathematics, or I might talk to my dad or something, and then I play the character.
Oh my God.
Oh, I love it. What do you mean, oh my God?
So, I just think, just listening to you, I feel like such a sort of flop house
person.
I mean, when there's things I have to do, if there's things I have to research, if a character does something, some sort of field of work that they're in, obviously I research a bit about that, but I'm not, we are just working completely different ways.
Yeah,
I mean,
are the person who played a CIA sniper and didn't know how to hold a gun.
Well, that was hilarious. The thing about, did I tell you this story? That the guy...
Sorry.
So, in the second season, I didn't even have a gun.
I said,
I'm not having a gun anymore. I don't want to have a gun.
I loved
so
it.
We would go into all these, we'd do all these, a big posse of police would go into something holding their guns. And I would walk in as though I had some impervious thing around me, that sort of secret force field that made me not have to have a gun. It was so ridiculous. And I said, I'm not having one. And I thought, what are they going to do? Fire me?
Yeah.
I'm number one on the call sheet. I don't want to have a gun. But in the first season, when I did have a gun, and I was very, I didn't want, it's not my thing to sort of be in a show where people shoot each other. But the only time I shot my gun was when I shot a glass of poisoned iced tea out of Whoopi Goldberg's hand, thereby saving her life.
Yes.
Thought that was pretty good.
And she was fighting to have that. She was like, does he really need to shoot it? Can't he just say, don't drink it?
Yes, I know. Yeah. She was fair enough.
She was like, what's going on here?
I was like, it's a dopey movie, Whoopi. What was our man, our police advisor?
Jimmy.
That lovely man who showed us things.
Yeah, Jimmy and Mike.
Ignored. So Mike was on the set, and it was one thing we came into a room and went, please freeze or something. I looked across at you.
Yeah.
And normally you were I'm towering above you.
Yeah.
But now you're right at my eye level. I thought, what the hell's going on? Is she in a hole? Did she fall down? But actually what it was, because my stance was so wide, and my gun stance was so wide, my legs were so wide apart. And Mike said to me, I went, oh gosh, Mike, this is a bit weird. What am I doing? And he went, your gun stance, Alan, it's a bit Broadway. That's what he said to me.
That's so good.
I was crushed.
That's so good.
I was very fussy. Oh. I was like, you know, I don't need a gun. I can just kill them with my dance moves.
Oh my God, that's so good. Do you know how, like, there was an interview that you did, or maybe it was with me and I had to stay silent when you, I can't remember what it was, but I remember hearing after we shot season two that you didn't hold a gun in season two. And I kind of triple took, and I was like, I'm the one who didn't want us to shoot for no reason. Why didn't I get to not hold a gun? And then I was like, well, because I played the detective. But I remember arguing with Michael. It was very funny. I remember arguing with Michael about certain things in the script because, so here's the deal with me doing that job. I didn't know anything about the police force in America apart from the little bits of racism, little being an understatement. But I didn't know that a detective was a police person, right? So I'm like, okay, I'm playing a detective. So I started researching detectives, and then I was like, oh, they're police. And at the same time, I was reading The New Jim Crow at work. And so I was sitting in that police chair, and there's a whole chapter. Oh my God. There's a whole chapter on police shows and how they perpetrate the myth of, like, they glorify the myth of the hero police and da-da-da-da-da, and, like, how much money is spent on violent crime, and it's, like, 1% of a police budget. It's really nothing. But these police shows make us think that that's all police do and all this. It was like, and I just, like, my heart sank, and I was like, shit. And so any time in the script that there was anything that was a little bit way too glorifying, I would go to Michael and I would say, oh, you know, this, I'm not comfortable with saying this like this. And he'd just be like, you're playing a cop. Yeah. Like, what are you on about?
I know.
And I would have these little arguments with him. It was very funny. And then when the gun thing, when I heard that you weren't carrying a gun, I was like, God damn it. He doesn't have to carry a gun, and I'm still stuck with this weapon. I'm still stuck with doing all
that. But you loved having your gun because it added to your list of props that you like. I was just always, this is the thing, Bayana loves props. Like we'd go, okay, let's go. We'd go to solve some murder and go somewhere to do something. And it would be like 5 minutes later, she's still picking up things that she's got on her desk. Her keys, her bag, her gun, her file, her handbag. It was absolutely hilarious. I never had any props. I always kept my hands in my pockets the entire time. I never touched anything unless I had to. It was so hilarious.
Well, I think if you can hold it, you can write your lines on the back of it. So that was my...
That is it. That was trick.
Yeah.
Tell us the rap.
Okay, so this happened when... Alan, do you remember, though, that we were tasked? So this was like at the beginning of the second season or the first season. I can't remember. You called me and you said, friend of mine wants us to write a rap about each other. And I was like, on it. And so I wrote two stanzas, and then you wrote one.
Who was it?
We were supposed to record a rap with some friend of yours. So here is mine. And it's a little bit. So I did it in a Jana Novak voice, which is a European voice, because of course that's the only way it rhymes. So it goes like this. What does he rate? He's so appreciate, definitely not straight. He's Alan Cummings, but without the S. I really need to stress, there is no fucking S. It's Alan Cumming.
Alan Cumming. That's so good. What was my one?
I remember your one. It goes, I know what you're saying. Good. Is she Serbian or Australian? But all you need to know, bitch, she's Bojana Novaković.
Kovic, oh, that's good. That's right. Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying. Is she Serbian or Australian? But all you need to know, bitch, she's Bojana Novaković. Oh, hilarious.
Yeah.
Who was it that asked us to do that? I couldn't hear when you said that before.
A friend of yours. I don't know.
Why?
You messaged me. I can't remember. I mean, you look at the first messages you ever sent me, if you've still got the same phone. I don't remember. And you said, you know, are you into that? And I was like, of course I'm into that. Let's write a rap. Because he was doing, like, he was pairing up people to do raps, and you were like, it would be really cool if the two of us did it because we're doing this show together. The date got delayed again and again and again, and then we just ended up making...
That was our thing on set, our little... Yeah. Everybody did it, didn't they?
Yeah, that was our little thing.
All You Need to Know, Bitch, by Jana Novaković, is that it's time to go now, and I want to thank you so much for this trip down memory lane, and I love this picture. It's such a lovely memory because it was like our first day of a really lovely experience. Two seasons of such fun and japes and really lovely people. And I look back on it with such fondness, even though we got cut off in our prime by the...
It was so fun.
Terrible sort of machinations of network TV.
It's so silly.
All right, boy, boy. Thanks so much for doing this. Thanks for taking that photo. I hope we made you do another photo shoot.
I'd love to.
Dressed in a ladies item and a bit of lipstick and I've got some pretty cool
cameras here with me. I'll come and take photos of you at club coming and stuff during the...
Or else we could go in our cars.
Oh, in our cars, and we can go somewhere.
You're going to have a car with my face on it.
I know.
Do you know your car that you're getting's got my face on it.
I know. It's painful. It's painful, but I'll live with it. I was like, what?
I said, because we get free cars from the festival, get Lexuses, because they're sponsoring this festival. And I was like, I am not driving a car with my face on it. So my one doesn't have my face on it, but yours does.
Oh, damn. I would drive a car with my face. Why didn't they put my face on your car? Oh, that's awesome.
All right, lovely.
Okay.
I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Lots of love. Bye. Well, I'm going to put my Polaroid of Bayana and me and Dan and Naveen away back on the shelves now. And I hope you've enjoyed this lovely chat. And I'll see you next time on Alan Cumming Shelves. Alan Cumming Shelves is hosted by me, Alan Cumming, and produced by the lovely Jack Claremont. We are part of the Acast Creator Network and the Crowd Network too. We just love networks. Another Crowd Network podcast to check out is The Joe Marler Show. Joe is an England rugby player, but here's the catch. His guests are normal people doing normal jobs. He's meeting teachers, chefs, stunt women, tattoo artists, marine biologists, astronauts, and soldiers. And he's asking all the questions you or I would ask. It's as simple as that, but it's also charming because everyone is interesting if you ask the right questions. Just search for The Joe Marler Show in your podcast app.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.